Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Franz Nicolai, the author of Humorless Ladies of Border Control, Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar. In the podcast, we talk about Nicolai's experiences touring throughout Eastern Europe, the Balkans, Russia, Ukraine, and Mongolia. We explore the role of punk music in these countries, who is attracted to punk music there, and what it's really like to tour.
Hello.
Hi there.
So let's start by exploring how this book came out. How did you decide to write about your touring experiences?
Well, this is one of the things about being a touring musician for a certain amount of years is that, you know, after you get through the first couple of years of excitement of filling the downtime with drinking and other kinds of debauchery, you find yourself with a lot of time on your hands. And, you know, people fill that time in various ways. I found it to be really useful time as someone who's interested in books and interested in writing, useful for raw material, because you're always in a new place, you're among interesting people. If you're a good observer and a sort of diligent observer, it becomes really good note-taking practice. And so I was writing longer and longer pieces to the point where it seemed like the next logical thing would be to tackle a book-length manuscript. At about the same time, circumstances came together so that I was going to be doing a pretty lengthy tour, the centerpiece of which was a month in Russia and a couple weeks in Ukraine before that. And I thought that that might be, if not the book itself, a good opportunity to make the heart of a book. And so I embarked on that tour with that in mind. And so that was sort of the beginning of it. And then I went back to Eastern Europe several times over the next few years and augmented the project from there. Part of the interesting thing about the way it developed was that, of course, in 2011, 2012, when I first went over there, there was still this sense that Russia was a kind of a political backwater. And so I was treating the book more as, you know, not just a tour diary, but, you know, because I wanted to make it tour diary plus. But if I was going to be interacting with anything outside of my own experiences, it was going to be the literary backdrop. You know, you can't write about traveling in the Balkans without acknowledging that, you know, without acknowledging Rebecca West. You can't write about the Trans-Siberian Railroad without acknowledging Chekhov and Thoreau and how, you know, however many others have written about that. You know, Eva Hoffman for Eastern Europe in general. And just sort of to be in dialogue with other people who had written about that sort of thing. By the end of the project, when I was going back to Ukraine in 2013, summer of 2014, that it had all suddenly become unexpectedly current politically. And so that added a different narrative structure to the thing, and especially a comparison to the way the kids I was talking to in Russia interacted with their political situation and the way the Ukrainian punks were interacting with theirs, made a sort of salutary comparison.
Well, yeah, that's one of the cool things about reading the book is that all of these like kind of major political events are sort of unfolding as you are just kind of going from town to town. And so I thought that was really interesting. So can you maybe talk about one or two of those kind of like big political moments, whether it's in Ukraine or Russia, that happened while you were there?
Well, the biggest one in summer 2014, I was touring in rural Western Ukraine by the Polish border. At this point, the Maidan Revolution had happened over the winter. The president had been driven into exile. Russia had responded by annexing Crimea and initiating the military provocations in the east. I happened to be out on at the time when the Malaysia Airlines flight got shot down. And so that was probably the biggest, you know, global newsmaking event that happened while I was on the ground. And it was interesting to see how the people in Western Ukraine reacted to that, which was for the most part, to dismiss it. But the we got to talk a lot about particularly the war in the East, which was really on everybody's mind, from festival organizers to people who knew people who had, you know, sort of packed into a car and driven across the country to the front to join the army.
Yeah. So as you were doing that, and you said that they kind of were dismissive. I guess one of the things that I've always thought about punk music, or dismissive of the events, but I always think of punk music as being very politically involved. And is that something that you were seeing or hearing in, as you were kind of meeting and talking with people?
It's such a complicated question, because sort of broadly, there's two schools of thought in punk rock. The first is that it's totally apolitical and just interested in provocation. That's sort of, I guess I associate that with like the late 70s British punk of, you know, wearing swastikas and, you know, Nazi uniforms and the sort of provocation for provocation's sake. And then there's the sort of more politically righteous wing that I guess takes off from the Clash, which is much more dominant now, especially in its sort of anarcho-punk, inspired by the 80s anarcho-punk British bands like Crass, or American bands like Fugazi, which is much more activist, leftist, anti-globalist, anti-corporate, much more attentive to language. And so that's a dispute that, or a misunderstanding in some cases. I mean, that's the root of the conversation I had with some of the Russian bands who were still more in touch with the older style of punk as provocation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I still see, even when you think as punk as provocation, it still seems political to me, maybe in a broader sense, and kind of reacting to and responding to kind of some things that are out there in culture and in cultural politics. So I guess that's where I was.
Sure, I mean, provocation is politics too. G.G. Allen has a politics, and the politics is nihilism, you know. And there are bands that still do that. The Dwarves come to mind, or, you know, Gwar, although what Gwar does is sort of different. But how it manifests on the ground is that the politically active punks, you know, have already created for themselves an alternative civil society, a community that operates by a different and more progressive set of rules than the larger polis that they live in. And that, because these are, you know, young, internet enabled, educated kids who see themselves as part of a global community, in which some of the people that are part of the members of that community that they feel that they belong to have more rights and opportunities than they do. And, you know, of course, thwarted expectations are a dangerous thing in a repressive or developing society. And so I think they find that useful in the same way that, people who belong to a church organization or people who belong to, you know, PEN or any other kind of international progressive community use that to find inspiration.
So one of the things I've noticed in just attending kind of punk shows kind of where I live is that it seems like there's this sort of increasing divide between the politics that are on stage and that the artists are sometimes articulating versus the sort of the political viewpoints of those people on the floor and in the mosh pit. Do you see that also happening maybe in Eastern Europe when you were touring?
Can you be more specific?
I really remember being at a show sort of right up to the lead up of the 2016 election here. And the band was, you know, very trying to get people excited for Hillary Clinton and trying to sort of kind of, you know, just really criticize Trump. And a lot of the people just in on the floor were just kind of yelling and booing throughout it. And it really was kind of strange to me that the artists really didn't seem like they were able to persuade the audience or even share like a political viewpoint with the audience.
Mm-hmm. I think that it probably depends where you are. my experience, at least in American punk rock, is that it's, you know, I would have been surprised to hear a band going all out for Hillary Clinton.
They weren't going all out, but they were
if you live in a politically conservative area, which I guess I'm assuming, then you're more likely to get an audience. That's the criticism I usually hear about American punk rock and to a certain extent European punk rock, is that it's so dogmatically leftist that it's a real preaching to the converted situation. That's more of a problem in a privileged and relatively liberal society. I mean, I think you'll get a situation where, you know, bands are either saying something they believe in or just sort of catering to what they think the crowd is likely to want to hear from them. You know, punk rock in the United States is a much less committed thing in a way. It tends to be something people to dip into for a couple years and then go on with their lives. One of the inspiring things about some of the people in the former communist world that I'm writing about, particularly in Ukraine, but also in Croatia and Serbia and to a certain extent Romania, is that they've taken on the really idealistic aspects of American punk rock in a way that means something to their lives in the long term and to their lives outside of the shows. Yeah.
Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on who are the people who listen to punk rock in Eastern Europe, the Balkans? Who's the audience? Who are the promoters? Who are the club owners?
Yeah, well, much like here, it's a primarily a middle-class phenomenon, right? You have to be aware of the larger global experience of it, you have to have an internet connection, for example. You have to speak pretty good English. So, you know, it tends to be people who are employed. It's not a real working class or underclass thing. That tends to, you know, those people are into like brutal metal or hip hop. So it's a, yeah, I guess I'm sort of repeating myself by saying it's educated young people with a progressive viewpoint, much like it is here.
Yeah. And so how big is the average venue that you played and how nice or fancy was it? Like, how does it compare to venues here?
I would say not big and not fancy. you know, these are DIY networks. So these are people who are not into music that's popular where they are. So they're putting it together themselves. They're putting it on in garages or in squats or in, you know, they're renting out a or not even renting out. They've made a deal with the local bar. They can put a show once in a while. You know, you're talking 50 or 100 people in any given city. Also, I'm not a huge act. So there's that also. But, you know, there's an aspect of coming to some of these places, you know, out in Siberia. I did some touring in China that didn't end up going in the book. But you're talking about going to cities of a couple million people, you know, but they're pretty far away. So there's an aspect of just showing up. You're bound to attract some people out of the novelty, or, you know, I was in a couple bands that people had heard of, so they would come check it out. You know, just people don't go to Novosibirsk or Omsk or wherever. And so you can get people out of the woodwork.
And so what was there when you showed up for your shows, and what were they sort of expecting from you, given your work with Hold Steady and some of the other bands you worked with and stuff? What were their expectations?
Well, they knew what I did solo also. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things about Russia is they have this social network called Kontakt, which is, if you can imagine, Facebook crossed with BitTorrent. It's social media plus media pirating. We're all familiar with all my records just from being like, oh, this show's coming up. Let me check out what he does if they hadn't checked it out already. So one of the knock-on effects of that being that they weren't interested in buying any CDs or anything. They were interested in vinyl and T-shirts, which were the objects that you couldn't pirate over the internet. So that's my advice for anyone touring over there is don't bother bringing CDs because they have that stuff. they've listened to the stuff online. Bring T-shirts and vinyl. I mean, they were familiar with it. I've played with a couple high profile bands but they're not necessarily high profile in the same communities. So these folks, by and large, were not interested in the Hold Steady or had ever heard of the Hold Steady, but they knew against me really well that I had played with for about a year. They knew the band Leftover Crack that I had been sort of associated with and some bands associated with that. Some of them knew World Inferno Friendship Society, the more punk associated bands.
You mentioned, trying to sell T-shirts and records. But in your book, you actually go into a little bit more detail about sort of the challenges of that bringing those things on this tour offered. So how easy or difficult was it for you to have T-shirts and vinyl for the audiences?
Well, really difficult. I mean, to a certain extent, it depends on how I'm getting around. So in Eastern Europe proper, I was in a rental car, so that made it a little easier. I could pack the car full of stuff. In Russia and Ukraine, I was on trains, either by myself or with my wife. And so it was a matter of how much could we squeeze into a backpack while also carrying three instruments and whatever clothes we needed. And so they were challenging. And then I was really running low on CDs by the time I got into Russia. My label is in London, and I thought maybe I could get them to send some to St. Petersburg because I was going to be there for a week. But what people on both sides told me is like, listen, you send something into Russia, it's either going to get through customs in 2 days or maybe 3 months. Like, don't even bother. So there was a process of basically bootlegging my own CDs. We wandered around St. Petersburg and bought some paper and some blank CDs and just burned a bunch of CDs. And I made little drawings for special. And then we only had double XL T-shirts left. And there aren't nearly as many double XL people in Eastern Europe as there are in the United States. So we spent a night with some scissors and thread cutting them up and turning them into smalls and mediums.
And what about,
there's a little bit of improvisation.
Yeah. And what about, I thought I remember there was a moment where you were crossing some international borders and you were sort of having to, I don't know, maybe persuade the border guards that this really, you weren't really there for like selling things or touring. You were just, this was just kind of your stuff.
Well, that's the normal thing that you have to do to avoid paying customs on the merchandise. Right. Yeah. So if you're bringing CDs and T-shirts in, this is a particular problem at the Swiss border, actually. Of all the border crossings, the absolute hardest ones are Switzerland and Canada, weirdly enough. People don't think of that. I mean, you can just go to Serbia. That's not really not that hard. But getting into Switzerland or Canada with merch, you're looking at a couple hundred dollars out of your pocket. That's another piece of advice. Go into Switzerland the side way. Don't go over the main crossings. Yeah, I'm just, there are ways in which I was suspicious and there are ways in which I flew under the radar. You know, I know a couple other people, bands who have toured around Russia, and they're much more of a target, both for the police and for the right-wing gangs to come and try and disrupt their shows because it's obvious who they are and what they're doing. You know, me and my wife on a train with a backpack and instruments, we can plausibly just be backpacking tourists. On the other hand, me driving around in a rental car by the vagaries of scheduling, having to cross, the Hungarian border, the Serbian border, the Croatian border, you know, every day, the Slovenian border, forth, back and forth, they end up looking at your passport and being like, what the hell is this guy? Who is this guy? What's he doing? You know, especially if you're crossing in and out of the EU every day. And so basically they thought I was smuggling cigarettes. That was the scam, was, you know, buying cheap cigarettes in Serbia and smuggling them into the EU.
Well, one of the things that I never sort of thought about when you're talking about driving from place to place is, like, there were times, and it may have been actually when you were actually in France, but that you like were caught in a snowstorm and it took you like 7 hours to just go a few miles. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a bad stretch, because I was driving east from France to Serbia and there was this giant snowstorm. I got caught on the highway over France. Fortunately, I was also driving along with the snowstorm, so I was sort of chasing that snowstorm for the whole week, which was really not a lot of fun. Got caught in it on a mountain in Serbia also. Really the same storm. Yeah, there's all kinds of things that are logistical problems that don't have to do with the hour that you spend on stage. You know, ferry fares and car breakdowns and, you know, getting robbed and paying customs fees and, you know, all the things that are sort of invisible behind the scenes. It's a real logistical challenge because it's a little bit of an international pariah still. So one of the reasons that I'm able to drive around by myself and do this without someone with a giant atlas sitting in the passenger seat is, you know, having a GPS system, which has really detailed maps for almost everywhere I want to go, except Serbia, which is a giant blank spot in the GPS, other than the two international highways that sort of make an X, make a cross through the middle of the thing. It's otherwise totally blank. So anytime I was trying to get somewhere, call it up on my iPhone in the morning on the Wi-Fi and then take a bunch of screenshots and then just sort of try to follow that route during the day. Old fashioned in a way.
So, as I was reading your book, I was sort of thinking about sort of the two most visual images I had of touring, which are like, this is Spinal Tap and the Cameron Crowe movie, like Almost Famous. And I was thinking, you know, it seems like your book should almost be required reading for anyone who thinks that like touring is going to be this glamorous thing. And so was part of you writing for like maybe those people who are thinking about getting into music and what it's really like on the road?
Well, both of those movies, and yeah, of course, stuff like that, of course, has shaped people's perception of what it's like to being a touring musician. Those all happened 40 years ago.
Right.
And there's been a major change in the music industry, which is that there's not giant pools of money sloshing around anymore. As of about 2000, you know, around the turn of the 21st century, wherever you want to date it exactly. But the honest truth is, you know, touring has always been a little bit of a grind, aside from, you know, the 0.01% who travel that way. So, you know, and especially now when there was an idea after the collapse of the music industry, okay, now everyone's going to have to make their money touring. What happened, of course, is then you got a glut of touring bands and there just wasn't enough money to go around in terms of, you know, even people who like music aren't going out every night. So it's become, you know, increasingly difficult. There is a sweet spot, which is what I was hitting when I was driving by myself, which is that if you are in a position to tour by yourself, you can do it super economically. You know, if I'm in a rental car costs what, you know, 15 euros a day plus some gas. So if I can make 100 or 200 bucks a night, that's a pretty strong margin. You know, that entails being on the road 200, 250 days a year, but you can make a living that way. That's something I learned from, and you can use it to subsidize if you're interested in travel, going to places that you wouldn't otherwise be able to tour to. So if you're on a bus with a band and a couple crew guys, your overhead is so much that you can only go on the established tour. You know, you can do it in Manchester and Glasgow and Edinburgh in the UK. You can play Berlin and Hamburg and wherever else in Germany, but you're not going to go for the most part to anywhere that's off the beaten track. But if I'm touring by myself, I could set up a tour where I would say, okay, I'm going to go for a month. I'm going to do 2 weeks in Germany where I know I'm going to make money. And then I can use that to subsidize going to Bulgaria where it's going to be, or I'm just going to, you know, break even on merch and make a couple bucks.
I think one of the things that, or that you write about that was really kind of stunning to me was I think you were in Russia and how some of the punks were using using derogatory English words, especially sort of the N-word, but using it in a very different way. And so can you maybe talk a little bit about that and how those bands and those audiences were using the N-word there?
Sure. We think of punk as provocation, and the people who think of punk in the terms of, you know, what they would think of as righteous politics. And this happened to be a band that was thinking of it in terms of provocation and looking back to people like Patti Smith, who used the word in a song title, or, you know, some of the, you know, the British punks who accessorized with swastikas. They were saying why they could do that. Why couldn't we? They were saying, you know, we as Russians think of ourselves as, you know, pariahs on the international stage. We're outcasts. Why can't we, appropriate this word and use it to apply to us? So for me in the book, that was an occasion to really think about what cultural symbolism means in translation. To give a little historical background about what punk rock meant in the Soviet era. It came through Soviet channels primarily in its British incarnation when a lot of those, you know, Susie Sue, Lou Reed, Marky Smith, Johnny Rotten were playing with fascist imagery for its shock value, essentially only for its shock value. But that had a different valence in the Soviet Union, where Nazi Germany was the great historical enemy, you know, in the story of the glorious triumph of the Second World War. And so there was this sort of association between fascist posturing and being anti-government. Right, since the identity of the Soviet Union was so tied up in having defeated the Nazis, if you were against, one of the ways to get the attention and irritate the government was to play it pretending you were a fascist, and vice versa, the most damaging insult that the government could apply to someone or to an organization was to call them fascist. You still see this today. But the association of being punk, of being anti-government, became really tied up with fascist imagery in ways that are really difficult to entangle.
So kind of following on that kind of to today, I believe you were touring right after sort of the Pussy Riot events that were happening in Russia. And I was really intrigued in reading how the people who you were encountering, what their responses were to the band and what happened.
Yeah, I get this question almost every time I talk to somebody about the book, because for people, you know, for Westerners who've been paying attention in the past decade, if you hear Russia and punk, that automatically means Pussy Riot. And I did ask everyone I talked to, because that was the big story in the West at the moment, in 2012. And they were all just, you know, mystified, combination of sort of mystified and dismissive, because from their point of view, Pussy Riot wasn't a band, which was true. They weren't. They were an art collective that had done a sort of punk themed protest. But it wasn't like they were a working band that was operating on these touring circuits and working with the collectives that, you know, they just didn't recognize Pussy Riot as doing the same thing that they did.
What was their view about sort of the free speech issues that sort of really, I think, captured sort of American audiences?
Right. So this is the counter argument, is that Pussy Riot were a group, whether they were, whether you, you know, whether you just want to call them a band or not. And that's sort of a taxonomic question, not a more than anything else, but they were, you know, putting themselves on the line, their, you know, their bodies on the line in a way that these Russian punks who weren't. My dominant impression of the people on the Russian punk scene that I interacted with was political apathy and cynicism. They weren't going to protest. They didn't see the point. Nothing was ever going to change. They were just going to basically keep their heads down. They had their local problems with, in a couple places, with skinhead gangs that were trying to break up their shows. You know, they were, their concern was very, their use of punk rock was escapist. It was like, we're going to create this little, as Hakim Bey would say, temporary autonomous zone where we can pretend that the outside world doesn't exist, that Putin doesn't exist, that all of this will just go away for a short period of time and we can be among our own crowd, which in its way is a totally logical response to politics in Russia, but, you know, is not terrifically productive. And so in that sense, you have to give Pussy Riot credit, more credit than these guys were willing to give them.
And so, I mean, you went to so many places, and one of the ways that I enjoyed reading the book was actually I had my Google Maps constantly open, and I was trying to follow your path and trying to get pictures of these places.
And so, that's why I put the map in the front of the book.
Well, but I also, you know, was trying to get pictures, and so I was always trying to get the places.
I got you. Yeah.
But one place that you described a little bit, but I really wanted even more was, I think it was when you were in Mongolia, and just your description of the people and how once you cross that border, I mean, it was just totally different. So I don't know. I guess I don't know if I have a real question, but just tell me more about what it was like in those cities and how people dressed and just their interests.
Yeah. It's funny about border crossings. And I know this is not exactly your question and I'll get back to that, but you know, there's a lot of language around how borders are a construct and, you know, borders are, have a political meaning, but not a sociological meaning or, you know, a philosophical meaning, but there really is something about crossing a border. It tells you, there is something about it that tells you a lot about the country, about whether, what kind of value they place on people's first impressions and whether, you know, the difference between arriving by car versus arriving by train versus arriving in an airport. The crossing into Mongolia from Russia made a real big impression on me because of the bleakness of the Russia that I'd been experiencing for the previous couple of weeks, which was economically depressed. It was physically ugly in these Siberian post-industrial cities. It was psychologically depressing in many ways. And then, you know, we crossed into Mongolia. I think that was where the wheels get changed for the different track gauge. Maybe that was crossing into China. Maybe it wasn't there. It was just there's physically a different look about the people from an ethnic point of view, but also just there was color in the clothing and in the houses and in a way that I hadn't really seen in a while. Now, I had that being said, the crossing into China from the Mongolian southern border crossing town was equally dramatic, from what was really a dusty outpost into what felt like the 23rd century.
Yeah, that was one of those moments where I just felt like, oh, I had all these like completely wrong misconceptions of these places that you were visiting. And so that was just kind of fun for me to just kind of get the rug pulled out from underneath me. So that was good. So what was a place that really left an imprint on you and was like one of your favorite places that you visited on the tour, on the various tours?
It's a tricky question because it depends on so many different factors. You know, there are some places where the city themselves weren't as interesting, but the people were so fascinating. You know, I'm thinking of some of the characters in Krasnoyarsk or in Tomsk, which has was a very lovely city and had a sort of fascinating local architecture. But the people were so interesting to talk to, or the fellow that I returned to a couple times in Rijeka in Croatia, who was just a real fount of interesting information and opinions and perspectives. You know, some of the shows were better than others. I had an amazing show in Belgrade, although the city itself didn't make as much of an impression for a variety of reasons. Bulgaria, I guess if I had to pick one, just traveling around Bulgaria was a real eye opener, which had something to do with the people that I was traveling with, but also the incredible natural beauty of the country, which really reminded me of Montana in a way I didn't expect.
One thing that I really got out of the book, and maybe it wasn't completely accurate, but it seemed like these tours really coincided with a lot of life changes that you were experiencing personally, getting married, having a child. And it really felt like you were kind of, through the writing, kind of, I don't know, taking stock and making sense of some things and trying to figure out about touring. So what did you maybe learn about yourself personally on this tour?
It's a bit, I mean, it's such a complicated question. And part of it has to do with the framing of a book, yeah. Right? Life is taking place whether you're writing a book about it or not. you know, I got married outside of before the scope of the book. You know, my daughter did make an appearance toward the end of it. I mean, there's an aspect of this period of touring which was the most hectic, the most ambitious, the most action-packed of my 15 years of touring. You know, it felt like a kind of a culmination in terms of it can't get any harder or more interesting than this. So maybe I should take a breather and take stock of where I've gotten to. In part because, you know, from when I first started touring around 2000, I kept touring with less and less people. I started touring with a band of nine, and then with bands of five, and then by myself, which in a way was more liberating in terms of the places I could go. But of course, then you just end up having to deal with more and more stuff all by yourself. And there's an aspect of that that can't help but make you look around and say, what, you know, is this, in what ways is this working? In what ways is this not working? If only because you're spending, you know, especially driving around the United States, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours in the car every day by yourself, with plenty of time to take stock of your life. I mean, there was the culminating incident, which is the birth of my daughter, which meant that, like I said, you know, it took me, I had to be out on the road 6, 7 weeks at a time, 200, 250 days a year to make this work. And that just wasn't going to be logistically feasible. And so there's an aspect of crossfading because I was trying to figure out what was I going to creatively and professionally, what was I going to replace this touring life with. And what I came up with, you know, partly because I was able to get the book published and it did pretty well, is that I've replaced a lot of that with writing. And I think you can sort of see that at the end of the book, where that's heading.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So what have you been working on recently, and where can people find your work coming out in the near future?
Sure. Well, the easiest way is to go to franznikolai.com. That has all this stuff. I've got two book projects in the works right now. I'm halfway through a novel, and then I've got another nonfiction project. And there's various freelance writing along the way. I've got some book reviews for Slate that just ran, one in the Times book review that'll run in August. And that's the writing stuff. Musically, I've also been refocusing on composition, you know, stuff I can do from home. So I have a choral song cycle based on the work of the squatter artist Fly from the Lower East Side, called Peep Songs, that premiered in June. I just finished editing the recording of it, so that'll be released pretty soon. And then I've been collaborating with a choreographer named Allison Chase, formerly of the group, of the dance group Palabolas, on an evening length dance theater production, that's called No Plan B, that's going to be premiering, in Portland, Maine at the end, and at the, at UMaine Orono at the end of the summer. And that's a immersive multimedia thing with wall-to-wall music that's going to be mixed in surround sound. It's in a tent. All the dancers are, I'm led to believe, are going to have images project. There's a visual artist who's also collaborating with us, projecting images on the dancers all over the tent. It's going to be quite a cool event, I think. And then that music will be available. I'm going to release that after, in the fall as well.
That sounds excellent, and I can say that sometimes when I read books by musicians, I always sort of question, should they be writing books? But that's not the case with your writing. Your writing is really awesome and fantastic and deep and interesting, so I am excited to read more of your work. So
thanks, I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the New Books in Music podcast. Today I've been talking with Franz Nicolai, the author of Humorous Ladies of Border Control, Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar. This is your host, Richard Schur. Thank you for listening.